Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is June 7th, 2004. Today's session number is SCJ 2004-1. Today's speaker is John Schramm. And the lesson for today is Thomas Merton, Monk, Session 1 of Vocation, Living Faithfully. Let's listen in.
Tape ministry. And for the people who are hearing this tape, one way to introduce it is to give my name. I'm John Schramm. And to tell you what's on the whiteboard, that'll also give the title for the tape or the DVC or whatever they're making. It's a little hard to read because I opened those windows to get a light into the room, and then it kind of blocked it. So it says, Thomas Merton, Monk, or his monastic name, Father Lewis, born in 1915, died in 1968, and then 2.5 contributions toward living faithfully. The first is contemplative living, the second one is essential monasticism, and the third one is a surprise. I know it probably won't keep you here through supper wondering what the surprise is, but I tried to build in a little uncertainty about the presentation. Why would I choose, when we have living faithfully in a complicated modern world, a monk who lived 26 of his 52.5 years in a cloister in rural Kentucky, rarely left, and has been dead almost 40 years. Well, let me tell you about the week and the plan for the week. I was trying to think, I've probably been in hundreds of sessions in this room. I lived at Holden for 6 years. And I determined that there was an inverse proportion to the number of times that the presenter said there will be time for discussion at the end and the actual time for discussion at the end. So I want to be honest with you. As we move through the week, there will be more discussion at the end of the week. In fact, you will do, I hope, your own discerning about living faithfully. But in order to give some hints and some contributions from some people that have been important to Mary and myself, we've chosen to give you the life and writings and contribution and model of three people: Thomas Merton, Dorothy Day, and John Howard Yoder. Merton has been very important in my life, and I think one of the reasons I choose him is because it seems to me that we go in swings, and in the 60s it was more social action and the church in the streets and opposition to Vietnam, and now it's more spirituality and the inward journey, and the church wasn't on the streets. The Lutheran Church in Leavenworth was on the streets against Iraq War, but we took some abuse and lost some members over it. It isn't that much part of what we assume is the church's role today. Merton held those in balance, and I think has some contributions to make for us in this complicated and kind of gloomy age. I think there's a lot of despair right now. So first of all, let me introduce him a little bit to you. Not a long bio, but I should ask, are there people who have heard of Thomas Merton? Are there people who have read Thomas Merton? Is there anybody who has a master's degree in Merton studies? It would do well if I had a team teaching, if that's the case. Somebody may know much more than I about him. Okay. Born in 1915, and a kind of unstable childhood. His parents lived in Europe a lot because his father aspired to be a great painter and wasn't, but he wanted to be in Europe where there were great painters. So Merton was born in France, not a lot of money, and certainly not a religious home. His mother was nominally Quaker. His father never went to church. If you read Seven Story Mountain, I think there's one reference that the family went once to a Lutheran church and didn't like it very well. But they were not a church family. Merton did not grow up with a religious upbringing. They moved to Long Island when he was one, and his mother died by the time he was six. So then he was with this father who traveled a lot and didn't have a real nurturing family life. So Merton went over to France again, went to boarding school in England, and by the time, and I think I have his age right, by the time he was 16, his father had also died. Then he was alone and was raised by his grandparents in Long Island. But one of the insights into Merton that I think bodes well for his insights into life itself was the hospital in England where his father died and his reaction to that. I'll just share that from Seven Story Mountain. By the way, when I have met people who say, Merton, I don't like Merton, I usually ask, you read only Seven Story Mountain, right? And often that's the case. Don't start with it. Merton later called it an arrogant book. He's a recent convert. How do you like being with a recent convert to anything? He had all the answers, and all parochial Catholic school kids used to have to read this. I don't know if they do now or not, but don't start with this one. But after you get to know him, and if you want to find out more about his life, then go to it, but not first. Merton was apologetic that in an English stoical hospital, he broke down and cried when his father died. So he kind of is honest in sharing that. And then he shares, what do you do with suffering? This is what he says. What could I make of so much suffering? There was no way for me or for anyone else in the family to get anything out of it. It was a raw wound for which there was no adequate relief. You just had to take it. We were in the condition of most of the world, the condition of people without faith in the presence of war, disease, pain, starvation, suffering, plague, bombardment, and death. You just had to take it like a dumb animal. Try to avoid it if you could, but you must eventually reach the point where you can't avoid it anymore. So you take it. You try to stupefy yourself if you like so that it won't hurt so much, but you will always have to take some of it and it will devour you in the end. Indeed, the truth that many people never understand until it is too late is that the more you try to avoid suffering, the more you suffer. Because smaller and more insignificant things begin to torture you in proportion to your fear of being hurt. The one who does most to avoid suffering is in the end the one who suffers most. And his suffering comes to him from things so little and so trivial that one can say that it is no longer even objective at all. Merton, later writing about what it was like for him to now be alone in the world. By the way, he has no inclusive language. I'll try to look ahead, but please forgive him. He went to Columbia University, started as a young, I think 18-year-old, and went to maybe younger than that because he graduated at age 20. Very, very bright student in the courses that he liked. He did like Thomas Aquinas, even though he was not from a Roman Catholic background. Mark Van Dorn was his favorite teacher. He said of him, when you're in his class, you find out who you are. And that is a compliment to a teacher. He graduated and did some teaching in New York City College in literature. And while he was at Columbia University, he writes later about himself, I was a very worldly man. Well, for a monk to say that, you think, oh, sure. I don't know all that that meant. I'll give you three things that he probably meant by it. He did work on journalism at Columbia University, but it was the Humor magazine. And somewhat risque. I've seen copies of the thing in some Merton books with examples of the cartoons or the graphics and the kind of articles that there were. He drank a lot of beer, that was for sure. And he probably fathered a child. Well, if those three things make you a worldly man, at least it's not what you think of as the later Merton, a monk in a monastery in Kentucky. He, at age 23, went and rang a bell outside of Holy Trinity Lutheran Church, very close, or Holy Trinity Catholic Church, very close to Columbia University. I went there when I was visiting Union Seminary just to see the door, and the bell is still there. A priest answered, and he said, "Father, I want to be a Catholic." It seemed very sudden to his friends and unexpected, but he took the instruction that this parish priest gave to people, was baptized, and was a Catholic, joined by a few of his student friends, including his best friend, who was Jewish. And from that point on, I think if you read Merton, his focus was, now how do I live faithfully? Once he was baptized, there was a consuming desire to fulfill that baptismal covenant and to have God at the center of his life. There was a hunger that I'm not sure all of us will have to live faithfully, but if you want to be inspired, you find someone who had that hunger and carried through with it. He thought maybe it would help to teach at St. Bonaventure, which was at least a Roman Catholic school, so he taught English Lit there, but that did not satisfy him. He went to the Franciscan, either monastery or educational institution in New York. He was very, very much enamored by St. Francis, but not by the wealth of the Franciscan order. They had a great library, magnificent buildings, and really lived a fairly, what Merton called, soft life, so that didn't appeal to him very much. There was one visit to Gethsemane Abbey in Kentucky, and that was what it took. That, from that point on, you could tell that that's what he was focused on, is the poor monks of a Cistercian monastery in Kentucky, probably the strictest order that there is, and certainly not a wealthy order. Merton later said, "We of all people are most lucky. It can't get any worse than this," in referring to life in this monastery in Kentucky. He finally decided that was his vocation. He gave his books to the Franciscans. He had seen their library. He gave his clothing to some places that he had worked in Harlem, where they gave clothing and food to the poor. He tore up two novels, and he gave a couple manuscripts to Mark Van Dorn, and with a duffel bag, the kind you take to the YMCA when you're going to play basketball, he knocked on the door of Gethsemane Abbey at age 26 and entered the novitiate there. So that's really his life before the next 26 years, our life in the Abbey, again consumed by this centering himself on God, even to the point that finally he got to live in a little cabin away from the monastery in the silence that he wanted so much. And in the process of that 26 years, he wrote. I can't believe how much he wrote. I used to bring the book just to show you the bibliography of 19 pages with small print of the things he wrote. And that doesn't include 12 substantial journals and thousands of letters of correspondence all over the world, especially with Eastern religion people that he connected with and felt a union with. So that's the monk. The end of his life is also dramatic, I would say dramatic. He had wanted to take a journey to Bangkok to meet some of the Buddhist friends that he was writing with. In fact, there's speculation that he wasn't going to come back, either to Kentucky or to Christianity. I don't think that's true. I think the people who knew him best and the other monks do not think that's true. He said that the reason that he was so connected to these people in the East and in the other religions is they had helped him go deeper in his own religion, not try to get him to leave it. And he felt indebted to them and in a kinship with them. So he did get to travel finally. The head of the monastery doesn't let people travel very often, I guess, like that. But he did get to go to Bangkok. And as a visiting monk, he was giving some lectures. And one day he gave a lecture, and his last words were, "And now I will disappear." Well, they make a lot about that. I think he meant the lecture's over. Take a break. The bell just rang. You can leave now. But anyway, those were his last words. "And now I shall disappear." It was a very hot day. The floors were tile. There was some water on the floor. He had just taken a shower to try to cool off. And when he went to turn on a very large electric fan, there was a short, a wire, and it shocked him such that it threw his body down, threw the fan on top of him, and electrocuted him with the fan on top of this of his body. In fact, it was so disfigured and discolored that people like to make a lot of connections for Merton. By the way, there are 36 Merton books in the library here. I didn't know that until I looked it up today. So there are a lot of them. People like to make a lot of this last thing he wrote in Seven Story Mountain, too. But you shall taste the true solitude of my anguish and my poverty, and I shall lead you into the high places. This is God speaking to him. He's writing it, but it's as though God is speaking to him. And I shall lead you into the high places of my joy, and you shall die in me and find all things in my mercy, which has created you for this end and brought you from Prods to Bermuda, to San Antonin, to Ockham, to London, to Cambridge, to Rome, to New York, to Columbia, to Corpus Christi, to St. Bonaventure, and to the Cistercian Abbey of the poor men who labor in Gethsemane, that you may become the brother of God and to learn to know the Christ of the burnt man. It is a strange way that he ended his early autobiography, and then that's the way that he died. How do you get to know him? Well, there are some tapes, very expensive. Probably a few videos, I've seen at least one where you get to see what he looks like. And there are a lot of books about him. Henry Nouwen has a good one. And there are some people who really do kind of connect with Merton and introduce him to you and select, as I have today, certain writings which give you a picture, because he wrote way too much. And some of it is not very good. But I think the best thing is to start by reading some Merton. So I have selected some today, and I hope they introduce you a little bit to it, and I hope they make the contributions. I've grouped them under these 2.5 headings, and the first is A New Understanding of Contemplative Living. The bookstore has the one book I recommended, New Seeds of Contemplation. I would think if there's going to be any book that really wears well and is still around for a long time, it'll probably be this one. What Merton did to contemplation was to let it be something that was part of anyone's living faithfully. And he had to do a lot of what contemplation is not in the beginning of this book to undo our sense that only a monk in solitude, away from all the distractions of the world, maybe high up on a mountain, sitting with eyeballs rolled up in constant religious ecstasy, that's the only kind of contemplative there are. And he undoes that as well as anybody has ever undone anything. First of all, it is a visual term. Contemplation is a visual term. It's not think about like meditate, it's to see. And Merton's major contribution is what we're called on is not to see some different world, but to see this world differently. And that makes a tremendous change in living faithfully. It's not to withdraw from this world into another world and see that one instead of this one. It's to see this one with eyes of fire and eyes of faith. And that changes everything. And Merton makes that contribution throughout much, much of his writings. Let me just share a few things with you. So that you get some idea, and then we'll have a little discussion about contemplation. More than 12 years have passed between the first and the second editions of this book. First one's called Seeds of Contemplation, the second one, New Seeds of Contemplation. Not very imaginative, but honest. When the book was first written, the author had no experience in confronting the needs and problems of the other people of the world. The book was written in a kind of isolation in which the author was alone with his own experience of the contemplative life. And such a book can be written best, perhaps only, in solitude. But now, as a result of a new perspective, many questions confronted the writer on taking up this old work again. Not least was the very use of the word contemplation. It is a misleading word in many, many respects. It raises great hopes that are all too likely to be illusory because they are misunderstood. it can become almost a magic word. Merton just thinks that's the exact opposite of faith, magic. It can become almost a magic word. Or if not magic, then inspirational, which is almost as bad. Put that up in your local Christian bookstore. Inspirational books, these are bad. Well, that's what we think it's all about, don't we? Merton does surprise you a little bit. There are many religious people who have no need for this book because theirs is a different kind of spirituality. If to them this book is without meaning, they should not feel concerned. On the other hand, there are perhaps people, even without formal religious affiliations, who will find in these pages something that appeals to them. And if they do, I'm glad. I feel myself a debtor to them more than I do to the others. That'll give you a little idea about contemplation and Merton's understanding of it. Let me give you just a few more from... He starts with three words. Contemplative living means to be alive, awake, and aware. Those are three pretty good ones to start with if you want to get a new sense of what Merton means by this kind of living. Contemplation is, above all, awareness of the reality of the source. It knows the source inexplicably, but with a certitude that goes both beyond reason and beyond simple faith. Contemplation is a kind of spiritual vision to which both reason and faith aspire. Let me give you a little bit in the chapter what contemplation is not. It cannot be taught. It cannot even be clearly explained. It can only be hinted at, suggested, pointed to, symbolized. It is not psychic peace. It is not prayerfulness or a tendency to find peace and satisfaction in liturgical rites. In the end, the contemplative suffers the anguish of realizing that he no longer knows what God is. Almost like Charlie's sermon last night. Let no one hope to find in contemplation an escape from conflict, anguish, or doubt. Are you beginning to get some idea of undoing this idea of constant religious ecstasy or certainty, and that it brings an invitation into the kind of living that is connected to the source and lives by mystery, but sees with the eyes of faith and the eyes of fire? I once made a page of Merton on contemplation. Let me share just a couple of those. Contemplation does not blind us to the world. It transforms our vision of the world and makes us see it, all people, and all the history of mankind in the light of God. True contemplation is not a psychological trick, it's a theological grace. The real contemplative standard is to have no standard at all. It's to be yourself. Indeed, we are invited to forget ourselves on purpose. Let's just stop there. Do you have some idea, if the theme is living faithfully, that maybe a starting point is for us to be able to see differently? That changes things. It's an invitation to be disillusioned. And the world is so full of illusions that we don't even realize that living faithfully would require that kind of change. If the eye is sound, the whole body is full of light, Jesus says. Merton said that's what contemplative living is all about, to experience that kind of transition or that kind of change. Are there some reactions or responses or questions about what we've said so far?
To me, it seems like there's a shift from, he's talking about the left brain approach.
Somewhat, okay.
Shifting it to the right, and it's very difficult to do, because because those of us who are the world is pretty much left brain, very cognitive, cause and effect, etc. And to go into this wilderness of faith, that's a leap of, you know, where are you going to land? And faith is right-brained.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Other responses? Would you have considered yourself a contemplative? I mean, was he right that you have to undo our preconceptions of...
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
I think all 5-year-olds are contemplatives.
I'm sorry?
I think all 5-year-olds are contemplatives.
Yeah, okay. All right. It's more childlike. More, okay. The new seeds of contemplation is probably not as simple as some of the other books. I do think it's profound. There are several places where I think it specifically has to do with our vocation and with our living faithfully and our being called. A couple of them kind of bring me up short. Indecision and fickleness are signs of self-love. If you can never make up your mind what God wills for you, but are always veering from one opinion to another, and from one practice to another, from one method to another, it may be an indication that you're trying to get around God's will and do your own will with a quiet conscience. As soon as God gets you in one church, you want to be in another. And as soon as you taste one way of prayer, you want to try another. You're always making resolutions, and then you break them by counter-resolutions. You ask your confessor, but you do not remember the answers. Before you finish one book, you begin another. And with every book you read, you change the whole plan of your interior life. Soon you'll have no interior life at all. Your whole existence will be a patchwork of confused desires and daydreams in which you do nothing except defeat the work of grace. For all this is an elaborate subconscious device of your nature to resist God. So keep still and let God do some of the work. The two contributions, I'm not going to spend more time. It's 10 after. We're almost halfway through the session, and I have the other two and a half, or the other half contribution and the full contribution. The first two are certainly connected. If you don't see another world but see this world differently, there's going to be a result in that, almost an inevitable result. And that's where Merton makes the primary contribution about essential monasticism. For Merton, male, cloistered, celibate, those are accidents, not essentials. Those are accidents. May be helpful. Many times when he writes, they are not helpful to essential monasticism. He is critical, probably more than most monks who wrote, of the whole enterprise of monasticism. But anyway, essentially, and I'll give the exact quote, the monk is essentially someone who takes up a critical attitude toward the world and toward its structures. The monk must return from the desert like Jesus or Saint John, with a capacity for feeling expanded and deepened. This is precisely the monk's chief service to the world, this silence, this listening, this questioning, this humble and courageous exposure of what the world ignores about itself, both the good and the bad, ignores about itself, both the beauty and the brokenness. The world numbs itself to both, entertains itself to death. How would denial of death, who's that author?
Becker.
How would he say it? We are drinking or drugging ourselves into oblivion, or we go shopping, which is the same thing. Merton says, if you begin to see the world differently, you will find yourself critical and counterculture and calling into question the world structures. And this he does with many, many of his writings. Let me share just a few of them. That the monastery and the monastic life is not separate from the rest of his life is clearly said in Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander. This was the book I started with, my first introduction to Merton. And this one cost $1.45, so you know when I bought it. probably the most readable journal that Merton wrote. And I was so pleased that Marcus Borg, in his last book, The Heart of Christianity, sees Merton's conversion to being connected to other people in the world as one of the thin places. Marcus Borg likes that phrase, thin places, where we can't talk about transcendence anymore because we don't have a three-story universe. You can't talk about, so you have to talk about transparency, where the awe oozes through. Well, those are the thin places in life where the holy connects with us. And for Merton, it was this ordinary. In Louisville, at the corner of 4th and Walnut, in the center of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed with a realization that I loved these people. That they were mine and I was theirs. That we could not be alien to one another even though we were total strangers. It was like waking from a dream of separateness, of spurious self-isolation in a special world, in a world of renunciation and supposed holiness. The whole illusion of a separate, holy existence is a dream. Not that I question the reality of my vocation or of monastic life, but the conception of separation from the world that we have in the monastery too easily presents itself as a complete illusion. The illusion that by making vows we become a different species of being, pseudo-angels. Certainly these traditional values are very real, but their reality is not of an order outside everyday existence in a contingent world, nor does it entitle one to despise the secular. Though out of the world, we are in the same world as everybody else, the world of the bomb, the world of race, the world of race hatred, the world of technology, the world of mass media, big business, revolution, and all the rest. We take a different attitude to all these things, for we belong to God, yet so does everybody else belong to God. We just happen to be conscious of it and to make a profession out of this consciousness. But does that entitle us to consider ourselves different or even better than others? The idea is preposterous. Monasticism does not separate, but it is a conscious decision to live out this understanding and to live contrary to the world's values by your whole life. In some sense, Holden does too. I mean, they used to say to me when I lived here for 6 years, what do you do when you get out into the real world? And I said, real world? You mean the Wenatchee Mall? The real world. Merton says what he left was a world in which manufactured needs were met with manufactured goods. And he walked away from that. The hardest thing is our call to stay in the middle of that stuff and not be caught up by it. That's harder than monastic living. And Merton knows that. And commends us and says, if I can give you hints, if I can make a contribution to essential monasticism and share it with you where you live, then he's taken away some of that separateness. That's what we're talking about. He uses breakdown and then says this will not be understood very well. But let me give you his idea of the world of breakdown. In one word, the only way in which I can make sense in the unparalleled confusion and absurdity of the breakdown of Western culture is to recognize myself as part of a society both sentenced and redeemed. This is almost 40 years ago that he's writing this. Is it changed? A society which, if it can accept sentence and redemption, will live. a society which has received the mercy of Christ and has been unfaithful. If my society cannot face this truth, it will destroy itself and perhaps everyone else besides. Once again, let me be clear about the word breakdown, because it's bound to be taken as an incomprehensible affront by all those who are firmly convinced that the technological power of our society represents the highest development of man, the beginning of the golden age of plenty, and the perfect freedom. I'm as ready as the next one to admire the astonishing achievements of technology. Taken by themselves, they're magnificent, but taken in the context of unbalance with the other aspects of human existence in the world, the very splendor and rapidity of technological development is a factor of disintegration. The Greeks believed that when a man had too much power for his own goods, the gods ruined him by helping him increase his power at the expense of wisdom, prudence, temperance, and humanity, until it led automatically to his own destruction. I'm afraid that's a little prophetic. One other section from... The last thing the salesman wants is for the buyer to become content. You are of no use in our affluent society unless you are always just about to grasp what you never have. And again, the Greeks were not as smart as we are. In their primitive way, they put Tantalus in hell. Madison Avenue would convince us that Tantalus is in fact in heaven. To see this world differently is to stand in contradiction to many of the values all around us. Merton wrote an interesting book called Emblems of the Season of Fury, and I'll read just one quote from that. Again, this is in 1961. I hear they are working on a bomb that will destroy nothing but life. Men, animals, birds, perhaps also vegetation. But the bomb will leave buildings, factories, railways, and natural resources. Only one further step and the weapon will be one of absolute perfection. The bomb should destroy books, works of art, all musical instruments, toys, tools, and gardens. But not destroy flags, weapons, gallows, electric chairs, gas chambers, instruments of torture, or straitjackets in case anyone survives. Then the era of love can finally begin. Merton wrote, that one got published, but Merton wrote things against the violence of war and the U.S. participation in it that he had to do under an assumed name. Even the monastery could not tolerate some of the seeing the structures of this world and of our own country as clearly as Merton saw them and as critical as Merton was of them when he saw them that way. I'm going to share a little bit from my favorite book, Raids on the Unspeakable. This is essential monasticism. You would have to get the book to understand what the unspeakable is, but you'll understand raids is to take it on. All right, I'll even read the prologue to this one because I love it. Well, raids, he speaks to his books. Let him have that much. Well, Rage, you're grown up now. It's time for you to go out and meet people, as the other books have had to do. And they've usually managed pretty well on their own. They were, for the most part, good-mannered. Some of them were even devout. As for you, you may need special advice. I must say you've proved yourself to be a little unusual. I think it's your poetic temperament. I would hardly call you devout, though I have found you meditating in your own way, but you don't do it in church. You must remember that most of your brothers went to the seminary, and you'll be expected to act like a seminarian yourself. This, I fear, is where you're going to run into trouble. At the end of the prologue, he says, you're not big enough to accuse the whole age very effectively. Let's just say you are in dissent. Maybe that's a more modest way to say what we're called to be when we live faithfully. Don't take on the whole world and change it. Just be in dissent. Dissent is to refuse to sit at the table. Santari dissent. I mean, I'm in the room, but I'm not sitting at the table with you on that one. You are in no position to issue commands, but you can speak some words of hope. Shall this be the substance of your message? That we are called to be human in this most inhuman of ages? That we're to guard the image of human, for it is the image of God? You agree? Good. Then go with my blessing. But I warn you, do not expect to make many friends. And as for the unspeakable, his implacable presence will not be disturbed by a little fellow like you. So he sends raids out into the world. Let me read you, I thought of this one this morning. I didn't go out and walk in the woods, I should have, but I did reread Merton again, which is I live in my head instead of in the woods, right? Let me say this before rain becomes a utility that they can plan and distribute for money. By they, I mean the people who cannot understand that rain is a festival, who do not appreciate its gratuity, who think that what has no price has no value, that what cannot be sold is not real, so that the only way to make something actual is to place it on the market. The time will come when they will sell you, even your rain. At the moment, it is still free, and I'm in it, and I celebrate its gratuity and its meaninglessness. And then there's one where he talks about his Coleman lantern, that I think is. They, and he means the world, they are convinced that here in the woods I'm having fun, and he puts having fun in italics. This has already been brought home to me with a wallop by my Coleman lantern. It's a beautiful lamp. It burns white gas, and it sings viciously. It gives out splendid green light in which I read Philoxenus, a 6th century Syrian hermit. Wonderful. Philoxenus fits in with the rain and with the festival. Of this more later. Meanwhile, what does my Coleman lantern tell me? Well, Coleman's philosophy is printed on the cardboard box, which I have, very guiltily, not shellacked, as it said I must do, to save the lamp. In fact, I tossed it in the woodshed, behind all the hickory chunks. Coleman said on the box that light is good, and it has a reason. It stretches days to give more hours of fun. Can't I just be in the woods without any special season? Just being in the woods at night in the cabin is something too excellent to be justified or then explained. It just is. There are always a few people who are in the woods at night in the rain. If there were not, the world would have ended. And going from that kind of delightful rain and the festival of rain to another taking on the world in a devout meditation in the memory of Adolf Eichmann. I wish I could read the whole one here, but maybe you can get the book some. One of the most disturbing facts that came in the Eichmann trial was that a psychiatrist examined him and pronounced him perfectly sane. I don't doubt it at all. That's precisely what I find so disturbing. If all the Nazis had been psychotics, as some of the leaders probably were, their appalling cruelty would have been in some sense easier to understand. It is much worse to consider this calm, well-balanced, unperturbed official conscientiously going about his desk work. his administrative job, which happened to be the supervision of mass murder. He was thoughtful, orderly, unimaginative, had a profound respect for system, for law and order. He was obedient, loyal, a faithful officer of a great state, and he served his government very well. We can no longer assume that because a man is sane, he's therefore in his right mind. The whole concept of sanity in a society where spiritual values have lost their meaning is itself meaningless. A man can be sane in the limited sense that he's not impeded by his disordered emotions from acting in a cool, orderly manner according to the needs and dictates of the social situation in which he finds himself. He can be perfectly adjusted. God knows, perhaps such people can be perfectly adjusted in hell. No, Eichmann was sane. The generals and the fighters on both sides in World War II and every war since, including Iraq, I added that, the ones who carried out the total destruction of entire cities, they were sane. Those who have invented and developed atomic bombs, thermonuclear bombs, missiles, who have planned the strategy of the next war, who have evaluated the various possibilities of using bacterial and chemical agents, these are not crazy people, they are sane people. The ones who coolly estimate how many millions of victims can be considered expendable in a nuclear war, I presume they do fine on a Rorschach test. On the other hand, you'll probably find that the pacifists, or the ban the bomb people, are quite seriously, just as we read in Time magazine, a little crazy. I'm beginning to realize that sanity is no longer a value or an end in itself. The sanity of modern man is about as useful as the huge bulk and muscles of a dinosaur. If we were a little less sane, a little more doubtful, a little more aware of absurdities and contradictions, perhaps there might be a possibility of our survival. But if one is sane, too sane, perhaps we must say that in a society like ours, the worst insanity is to be totally without anxiety, to be totally sane. I thought of William Sloane Coffin. He has a great line. It's the cracked ones that let the light through. That's heavy stuff. Heavy stuff. Aren't there people who are giving us hints today? Probably. But I went back to Merton, and I think he's worth going back to for some directions on living faithfully. It's not easy stuff. I think if you read the Gospels, Jesus talking about living faithfully is not real easy either. So maybe we need sometimes somebody to kind of shock us into what this would mean, to see differently, not to see a different world, but this one differently, and then essentially stand in contradiction to the structures and the values and some of the things in the society around us. But since it was heavy, I thought the half point ought to be that he maintained a sense of humor. And that one probably surprised me more than either of the first two. Let me just share a couple of those points, and then we'll open it up. Let's see. By the way, the library does, I didn't have them order Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander, but the library does have a hard copy if you want to take it and read it. It's the most readable. Have you ever been to a monastery and had a meal with the monks? I went every week to St. Anselm's Abbey with the Benedictine monks. And since you maintain your silence, and it's a little awkward, by the way, if you're in a monastery and there's a rule of silence and you need the salt, which is at the other end of the table, do you know how you get it? I mean, do you?
Yeah, sign language.
No, you say, pass the salt, please. You do. That doesn't break the silence. I mean, break the silence is to sit next to somebody and think what you have to say is more important than that person's silence. That's what breaks the silence, not someone saying, pass the salt. I just wanted to let you know that. But there is a reader, and it does help to have, you don't have to listen to the reader, but there it's a little bit like having the TV or the radio on if the silence gets at all awkward. And with people eating and silverware and what have you, it's kind of nice to have something, and often you tune into it. Merton says the reader in the refectory this week, a particularly serious monk, announces at each meal the title of the book he was given to read. And the title of the book is A Right to be Merry. He drops his voice every time he comes to the word Merry, as if he hesitates to utter it, almost as if he would question the title altogether. God forbid, not a right to be merry. If anything in the book concerns eating or drinking, he dims his voice ever so slightly, with the same type of concern, as if withdrawing his will from under the word eat. He lets it float out on its own, irresponsibly, before the face of a divine reproof. But when he gets to words like dead or death, he lays them down squarely in the middle of the refectory with satisfaction and with utter finality. And then one of my favorites is a little tiny book. Reminded me a little bit of Dan Spencer, who was up at Holden with me here and came out as a gay man, is now the only, well, he left Drake, but was the only tenured, openly gay religion professor or philosophy professor in a college, I think. Wonderful man. And he used to get invited to give a talk on a day in the life of a gay man. So he would start by saying, well, I get up and I go to the bathroom and I brush my teeth. This is a little bit like that. He was asked to write about a day in the life of a monk. And he had just moved to the Hermitage, so he was just exuberant with this new silence that he had. But his humor does come out in it. And some of it is serious. But I like the humor better than the serious part. This is not a hermitage, it's a house. What I wear? Pants. What I do? I live. How I pray? I breathe. Who said Zen? Wash out your mouth if you said Zen. And if you see a meditation going by, shoot it. And who said love? Love is in the movies. The spiritual life is something that people worry about when they're so busy with something else that they think they ought to be spiritual. Spiritual life is guilt. But up here in the woods, it's the New Testament. That is to say, the wind comes through the trees and you breathe it. Is it supposed to be this clear? I'm not inviting anybody to try it or suggesting that one day the message will come saying, now, that's none of my business. One other place. Why live in the woods? Well, you have to live somewhere. Do you get lonely? Yes. Sometimes. Are you mad at people? No. Are you mad at your monastery? No. What do you think about the future of monasticism? Nothing. I don't think about it. Is it true that your bad back is due to yoga? No. Is it true that you're practicing Zen in secret? Pardon me, I don't speak English. Wouldn't it be nice to know? Thomas Merton Monk. We've got a few minutes. I don't know what you expected this week to be, living faithfully. You probably knew what Holden was going to be because most of you have been here before. But the sessions, vocation, what that word says to you, living faithfully, faith has an object. You can living faithfully. You can be faithful to the wrong thing and still live that way, so you probably assumed Christian content to it. But what's your reaction to having some mentors and going back and having a few inner companions like Merton along the way? What can it do for you to have some people who live faithfully? Do they inspire you? Do they intimidate you? How are you doing with the first go-around?
I think you have to worry about, what I think is that Merton is, he's wonderful, he has all this incredibly elegant and articulate thoughts, and I think it's a danger for me to stay there.
To stay there.
To stay reading.
Oh, reading.
And sort of just staying up here and not thinking about it on my own. I mean, I just sort of mental gymnastics all the time, and not really internalizing it, and actually trying to live faithfully myself. You can just read all the stuff and say, "Oh, wow!" Now I'm reading a book right now that I found. I'm like, "Ooh,
yeah.
This is good."
Okay.
And that's the danger of teaching too, is because you can stay up here. And you don't really have to do it yourself. Or you should, I mean, you need to, mm-hmm. but you can stay up there. So that's just what I worry about for my own growth.
Okay, that's very helpful. And it's ironic, because what he was trying to do is make contemplative living accessible to everybody. He starts by saying, the problem is not that it's too complicated for people to grasp, it's too simple for people to get. And he goes on to do that. And when he was in person with a group, there was a group that invited him to lead a retreat on prayer. And his talk, orientation of the retreat, was like 2 minutes. If it's prayer that you want to do while we're here, then let's pray.
Yeah.
What I have to say about it is not important. Prayer is. And he sent them out for 2 days to pray and didn't give a talk. He was with them, but so he did try to not only make it accessible, but to push you to do your contemplative living and encourage you to stand in contradiction to the prevailing values of the world. And it is good to see some people who do it, but it's also kind of intimidating or ironic. Thank you, Amy. That's helpful. And it's easy to stay up here. It is for me. Oh, I love to read this stuff. Yes?
As an artist, I was interested in what you had to say about it being a visual, contemplation being a visual thing. I haven't really thought of that before. Could anybody expound on it a little bit for me? I don't know. I'm trying to understand that.
What's the dictionary definition of contemplation?
What's the Latin root?
Hmm?
What's the Latin root?
It's to view or to see. I mean, it is a visual term, but I don't have the dictionary definition or know that.
But I mean, I'm thinking of the process of contemplation,
uh-huh.
to see things differently. Is that?
Yeah. What happens after that?
You live faithfully.
Yeah, right. I think what he was talking about, the visual, the alive, awake, aware.
Mm-hmm.
And an awareness kind of.
Yeah.
And he was good friends with Thich Nhat Hanh, currently, who is a Zen Buddhist, mm-hmm. Who practices the art of mindfulness, where even making yourself a cup of tea, be aware of the hot water, that, you know, just really be alive, awake, and aware. And I think that's very much seeing the world.
Mm-hmm. There are probably some chapters in there that would be more helpful toward that particular.
Well, in my art making, I mean, that's
uh-huh.
very contemplative,
uh-huh.
you know? So that was an interesting thing to be connecting with.
Teilhard de Chardin said, all of life is in that verb to see, or seeing. So not just right brain and left brain, but a lot of that is connected. Good. Yes?
I enjoyed your bringing up Marcus Borg's latest book,
Heart of Christianity.
I had the privilege of hearing him speak about his book, and I liked the fact that you brought up thin places.
Thin places.
Because I think maybe that's what Merton is talking about, is finding the thin places in the ordinary.
Uh-huh.
And this morning I experienced a thin place down at the Holden Bed and Breakfast. I was sitting on the porch attempting to pray, and my prayer was to watch all of the birds.
Uh-huh.
And they were swooping over me, and there was such a variety of birds, I found myself literally weeping. And I thought, aha, this is a thin place. This is a way of seeing the world contemplatively, because then I got off on this tangent. How can we maintain habitat and, you know, so forth and so on? And how can I share my enthusiasm for birds to other people? So I think that may be one way to live faithfully, is to share my love for bird watching.
Thank you. We're almost out of time. Is there somebody who's going to be frustrated that they didn't say what was on their mind?
I just found it helpful to think of contemplation as a way of looking at culture, whether it's the culture of a church institution, but more principally, like what is democracy and the ability to be contemplative in terms of a dissent, which I think if we don't start really doing some of that, I don't know what we have.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for your interest. One of the nice things about Holden, if you're going to be here all week, is that we can continue in the off hours, doing some conversations, and you do your own contemplative living this week. And I hope that I hope that bringing several models these first few days does inspire or give you some clues, and not have you live in your head or be intimidated by them, but instead kind of accept the gift that they bring us. Thank you.